You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
The largest threat that Ukraine faces today, Russia's continued aggression in the East. Now, there's no other way to call it.
US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Kiev, and Angela Merkel and François Hollande join him with their new peace proposal. Tim Marshall and Shashank Joshi will be here in the studio to discuss this, as well as the day's other top stories. Then we'll hear what's on offer at the first ever Bhutan International Festival.
This is an opportunity to bring some of the best minds together, but also for emerging artists who want to be able to have time with professionals to experience creating new work and sharing their artistic disciplines.
We will also leaf through the news weeklies in France and we'll review the most interesting new book releases. That's all coming up here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A busy hour in prospect then. Before we start, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Paul Osborne. The leaders of France and Germany have met Ukraine's president as a new diplomatic push to end the crisis in the country intensifies. François Hollande and Angela Merkel are presenting a new peace plan, but Mr. Hollande has warned that if it fails, he could supply weapons to Ukrainian government forces. Both leaders are due to meet the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, on Friday. Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, says they need international support.
We are facing another growing escalation of violence by terrorists directly supported by Moscow, their refusal to fulfill obligation on the Minsk Agreement, their barbarian attack on the civilian population, which led to multiple casualties every day.
As tensions continue to rise over the latest surge in violence in Ukraine, NATO defense ministers have been discussing what officials have called the biggest strategic switch since the end of the Cold War. A new rapid reaction force is to be set up in Eastern Europe with up to 5,000 personnel. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says he wants to reassure allies bordering Russia.
We are setting up a joint training center in Tbilisi. There, NATO troops, Georgian troops and forces from partner nations will train and exercise together.
There's been no breakthrough in the latest talks on Greece's huge debts. The country's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, travelled to Berlin for talks with his German opposite number, warning that Greece would not be humiliated. The country's new anti-austerity government wants to renegotiate the terms of its huge bailout. But Jerry Rice from the International Monetary Fund says that so far they've had no details of a Greek proposal.
There was an introductory meeting with the authorities over the weekend. Specific policy issues were not discussed in any detail. We are looking forward to hearing from the authorities on their proposals, their ideas. We haven't had those discussions as yet.
The scandal involving the Brazilian state oil giant Petrobras appears to be widening. Police are now questioning the treasurer of the governing Workers' Party the day after Petrobras's chief executive resigned. It's claimed that firms paid over the odds of Petrobras contracts and the money was handed to the Workers' Party. Jordanian fighter jets have launched their first strikes against Islamic State militants since footage emerged of the murder of a hostage from the country. Mawas al-Kasasbeh was burned alive by IS, the video apparently released several weeks after he was killed. Jordan's King Abdullah earlier met the pilot's family. Meanwhile, President Obama has again warned the world must confront what he called the barbarity of Islamic State.
We have seen violence and terror perpetrated by those who profess to stand up for faith, their faith, profess to stand up for Islam, but in fact are betraying it. We see ISIL, a brutal, vicious death cult that, in the name of religion, carries out unspeakable acts of barbarism.
Iraq's prime minister has ordered the end of a nighttime curfew in Baghdad, which has been in place for more than 10 years. Haider al-Abadi says he wants life in the Iraqi capital to return to normal, despite the continuing battles with Islamic State militants who seize territory close to the city. The curfew has also reportedly been lifted in the city of Kabala to the south of Baghdad. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Time here in London is 6 minutes past the hour, 13:06 in New York City. Joining me with their take on the big stories of the day here in Studio One are both Shashank Joshi, a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor for Sky News. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme. It's been a busy day in Kiev, as we're hearing in the news. US Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in the city in the morning, shortly after it was revealed that German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the French President François Hollande were on their way to the Ukrainian capital too. The French and German leaders are to present a new peace proposal, which is supposed to be acceptable to all, according to President Hollande. Team Merkel-Hollande will continue from Kiev to Moscow, where they'll meet President Putin tomorrow. Shashank, perhaps I'll start with you. John Kerry suggested this is a critical moment for the region. He says he wants a diplomatic resolution, but he won't close his eyes to the tanks that are rolling across the border. Does that position really make much sense to you?
It's a characteristically John Kerry fudge. Of course, it's coming after reports that the US was intentionally floating a balloon saying it might arm the Ukrainian government. Obviously, with the intention they don't want to do this. They recognise that it would lead them down a dead end from their point of view. It's with a view to forcing Moscow to negotiate seriously on this Hollande-Merkel plan. Now, we don't know exactly what this plan consists of, although and how it differs from the previous abortive attempt we had at Minsk, which the Russians violated pretty quickly. One of the suggestions seems to be that the Ukrainian side is accepting this will be a frozen conflict. They will effectively cede control of their eastern provinces, but Russia has to take over administration, paying the wages, sending energy, looking after the frozen areas in the east, which of course is a major financial burden. Right now, the Ukrainian government is still sending gas, still paying federal salaries in these places. So that's really interesting. You know, the Ukrainians acquiescing in a frozen conflict in Eastern Europe. And the really big question is, how will they monitor it?
Tim, do you see it that way likewise?
All of that. And because a frozen conflict is about the best they can get out of it. I don't see, they're never going to get it back. So freeze it rather than just hand it over to Russia. This is a very good example of joined up diplomacy. I don't think the French and Germans have gone across there without having phone calls to Washington first. And I agree with Shawshank that when you look at what has happened in the past few days, the de facto defense secretary of the United States, who he's not been named, he's not in position yet, but he's going to be shortly, Ashton Carter. He testified to the Senate that he does think they should arm the Ukrainians. Then comes Obama saying, you know, maybe this isn't the right time. But then they let it go out there that the things that they're thinking of are Javelin anti-tank missiles, exactly the things that they need to stop the Russian armor in its various forms. So the Russians are reading these signals. They know that the defense secretary is saying yes, the president's saying no. They're floating it as an idea that if you don't talk nicely to the Germans and the French now, that is an option. Well, we wouldn't want to do that, you say? And I think they would, in the final analysis, do it. Mm. The Europeans, meanwhile, are saying, yeah, well, thanks for, sticking it to them a bit and giving us a stick with which to beat them. However, we really don't want even more arms flowing into this. We want to do the diplomatic. Yeah. And that's where they are at the moment. It's a sort of double bluff. Meanwhile, briefly, the strategy of the Russians is to push out a bit of extra territory, get round to Mariupol, which is a port into the Sea of Azov. The Sea of Azov goes into the Black Sea. If you take that, you can join Crimea up to the eastern bits of Ukraine that they control, and you've extended all your territory.
Shashank, what about this idea of what further arming might mean? I mean, some people are still suggesting that it could reduce the risk of a major escalation, whether it's defensive weaponry or otherwise. Right. others suggesting that it would sort of add fuel to the fire. It would be further sort of incendiary impact. Where do you sort of stand on that?
I think there's no question that additional weaponry, particularly things like anti-tank weapons, and the Ukrainians say they need, in particular, more radar and more UAVs to monitor Russian positions and so on, communication sets as well, that these would assist the Ukrainians to resist Russian-supported action. However, the question is, would it be decisive? And if it wouldn't be decisive, who has escalation dominance here? Who has A, more resolve in this crisis? Who does it matter to more, the United States or Russia? And B, who has more ease of supply over time? Can the Russians inject more forces in easily, or can the Americans? Who has more of a stomach for that as well, which goes back to resolve? And the answer to those two possibly suggests you can prolong a stalemate. What you can't do is force a decisive Ukrainian victory. And under those conditions, is a stalemate conducive to talks, or does it merely prolong the misery? Now, I'm glad the Americans have rather belatedly, I think they should have happened before Minsk, raised this idea, but I think we have to think very carefully about what it actually achieves, and it must be coupled with diplomacy. So I'm glad that, as Tim said, that they are engaging in this with joined-up diplomacy behind it.
There's a very brief one sentence to sum up that, and that is that the Ukrainians intrinsically know that Moscow is near and Washington is far away. And once you internalize that sentence, you know that who's got the upper hand, and it's the Russians.
Tim, what about NATO's role in all of this? Because we've obviously seen this sort of spearhead, this reinforcement, the biggest since the Cold War, this kind of thing. Obviously, that offers reassurance to certain NATO members. Do you think there's an element to which NATO, its credibility requires the extra muscle from the US? Is this a bit of a damning indictment in some ways of what NATO represents to miscreants like Putin and others?
NATO is not militarily involved. NATO would not give weapons. The French, just yesterday, the defense minister said, we do not support Ukraine's NATO membership, because that's a red line. That would lead to a war, Ukraine's NATO membership. And as they are outside of NATO, NATO can actually say, we're backing off a little bit, and that is what they're doing. And at the same time, NATO has to send a signal, this far and no further. Don't forget Article 5 of the NATO Charter. An attack on one is an attack on all. So if you try the Baltic states, you're going to be in trouble. But this, let's just freeze this.
Is that a red line, do you think, that could shift? Or do you think that's...
I don't think... Well, I mean, I've said that Putin has won hands down, left, right and centre from the beginning of this. I stand by that, despite the sanctions. I think he will still continue. I also think, despite his provocations, I do think he's smart enough to draw the line at stepping into a NATO country. He can stir it up in the Baltics. Some of them have got 40% Russian populations.
He has been stirring it up in the Baltics.
Yes.
I mean, kidnapping an Estonian intelligence officer soil.
I don't think he would actually cross the border.
No, I don't either.
Is war, and nobody actually wants that, because he knows he won't get away with it. And that's why I think it's this far and no further. But he's winning.
Can I make one other comment to the backdrop here, which is also Greece, which looks like, I think, on the side stage here, but actually the presence of a new troublesome government. Putin's just invited the new head of state to Moscow. They have broken the European consensus on sanctions. I think Merkel and Hollande are also aware, unless they act soon, Greece could throw a spanner into the works, which is, of course, an additional reason why NATO, in which Greece is a pretty significant member, is also a potentially complicating factor, blocking a unanimous consensual action.
We'll talk a bit more about Greece a little later. One final thought on Ukraine. I just wanted to look, shifting our sights across the Atlantic to the sort of the domestic US political dimension to this. We've had this Brookings Institute report suggesting that a more aggressive stance is recommended. Do you think that, I mean, politically, is it all going to be a bit of a damp squib? You've got the second term president, Tim, who is obviously very interested in trying to safeguard his legacy, particularly when it comes to foreign affairs. Is it likely that there'll be much, manoeuvre there? There's obviously a lot of dissent even within, the Democratic side about what the right action would be. Is it an interesting forum, or do you think it will just kind of bubble under as we look towards 2016 in the US?
I think it'll bubble under unless Putin pushes it. And if he's getting enough, he will quieten down again. I don't think they're bluffing. I think they might give weapons eventually. I think that's just the stick in order to try to get them to come to terms and freeze the conflict. But unless it blows up in their face, it's not going to be a big part of the 2016 debate.
Let's continue with the programme, talking a little bit more about the fight against the Islamic State. A new report here in the UK has urged Britain to do more in its fight against the jihadist group. The Defence Select Committee found the UK had carried out only 6% of coalition airstrikes against the militants and expressed concern that it was not doing more. Shashin, do you think people are really worried about who does what in percentage terms, or is that rather a meaningless statistic?
It's a bit of a, I don't know how to put this politely, urinating contest, I think. It's different countries have different proportions, but of course the UK is doing a lot that's unseen as well in terms of flying surveillance flights. Not many countries have the surveillance assets that the UK does, and that's really important here, because to give you an example, no one in the coalition is dropping many bombs in Anbar province to the west of Baghdad. Absolutely crucial. I mean, you know, this is where ISIS were before they broke onto the mainstream last summer, of course. They were in Fallujah and the Iraqi army was struggling. Well, we have struggled there because the weather's so bad we can't pick out targets. The UK's flights with Sentinels, with Reaper drones, even with its Tornadoes, with surveillance, with ISR, intelligence surveillance, reconnaissance pods, these are really crucial contributions. The other important point to make is the report by the committee today doesn't say we're not bombing enough. What it really says is we don't really know enough about our own strategy, and we could be giving more assistance indirectly to the Iraqis, training, arms, and so on. And it points out we've given 40 heavy machine guns to the Kurds. Well, the Germans have given us thousands and thousands and thousands. Again, it's not about the numbers. It's about the strategy and the support we're giving to local forces.
I'm with Shawshank. When I read the headlines this morning, I looked at the report. I just thought, there's not much in this, you know. Mm. Okay, apparently it's 6% of the airstrikes are British. Well, okay, that sounds, oh, it's terrible. Well, hang on a minute. There's about 12 countries in the coalition. Of those 12, the second most airstrikes have been carried out by the United Kingdom. So, I mean, are they doing a lot or are they not doing a lot? They're the second biggest contributor to the actual sharp end of the conflict. So I really didn't take that much notice of it. The one thing that did worry me, and Shawshank just alluded to it, they did say there are hardly any experts out there representing the British interests and learning. Mm. That worried me. But to me, it's not that much of a story. The ongoing debate is we're involved. They're going to stay that way. They're not going to escalate very much.
What I find incredible in that report was saying this was pre-crisis. At the time of, in the spring of 2014, there were three junior political officers in Baghdad tracking the political situation. And let's bear in mind, this was a political failure here. The failure to reach out to Sunni communities in Iraq, the failure to have a representative government. You had no defense section in Erbil in Kurdistan at all. So there's a much bigger challenge this is underlining for me, because I can tell you in a year's time, 2 years, whenever it is, we will have a crisis like this somewhere. Probably Libya, could be in the Sahel, could be anywhere. And we will all be talking about this saying, why do we only have two junior diplomats sitting in Benghazi? Why do we only have one consular, you know, defense engagement officer sitting in Sana'a? This is a repetitive problem. And that the committee's report is valuable for pointing that out, I think.
Tim, that strikes me as rather worrying. What's the answer to that? Why? I mean, I don't know.
Well, crystal ball.
Fixed British diplomacy.
You have your ear to the ground of these things. But that's really alarming, isn't it? This was obviously a bit of a tinderbox, and yet it appears there simply wasn't the resources directed at it. How can something like that happen?
There are human beings saying, I think we should do X, and sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. Either way, they put that proposal up, and there's people above them that say, either way, I can't afford it, or whatever. So, I mean, there is the human factor, and that you shouldn't portion too much blame always. But there are occasions when you can say, I don't understand why you didn't see that. And I do think that Iraq is one of them, because we were in Syria, we were in Iraq as journalists, and we kept saying there is no way in hell that the Syrian war is not going to bleed across. No way in hell. And if, you know, people down at my level knew that, I still don't understand why the higher echelons either didn't ring the alarm bell, or if they did, the people above them didn't. So I do think that's a failure. I do have some sympathy for where the next one comes, that, you know, neither of us know where it's going to be. I think those are good guesses, Sahel and Libya, but, you know, it could be somewhere else.
Sure.
But they can't
be
everywhere and they can't do everything. But Iraq and Syria was a failure of understanding the future.
Shashin, just on this point, if we're looking then at maybe some more radical notions, some more radical ideas for what might be done to address the IS threat, this ongoing problem, do you think it's time for you know, certain powers in the West to grapple with some really unpalatable questions, whether it's, you know, support for Assad, whether it's, you know, time for a more orthodox military intervention. Sure. Is it too soon to start talking about those?
No, it's not too soon. Those are both terrible ideas. I could have told you that months ago. And they're tempting ideas, the lure of a ready-made state partner on the ground in Syria to provide ground forces, the lure of clearing out Mosul by yourself. They're both awful ideas. On the one hand, the first of those would utterly, utterly alienate the very same population whose support you need to durably clear ISIS out of these Sunni-majority areas. And on the other hand, this is not 2003, where we're invading a country. There is a sovereign, democratic, elected Iraqi government which is improving itself, genuinely, and I'm impressed by the way Abadi has done so far. They do not want Western troops. I've done a lot of, you know, media over the past week where people say, well, should we have more boots on the ground? The Iraqi parliament is a sovereign parliament that will not accept that. They don't want that. The prime minister doesn't want that. So unless we're proposing we invade Iraq again over the heads of the government we're supposedly rescuing and whose invitation to us is a legal basis for our war itself, then that's impossible. Yeah. The only thing we can do is do more to prop up the local fighters on the ground. And I'm afraid there's no substitute for patient training. They want to rush into Mosul? Well, it's going to take time.
After that awful murder of the pilot, I tweeted, in our rage, let us not make hasty decisions. And going in there is just a nonsense.
Those are the insights of Tim Marshall and Shashank Joshi. He'll still be with me when we return in a moment or two to discuss, amongst other things, the meeting between the new Greek finance minister and his German counterpart that took place in Berlin today. Was it successful or not? You can probably guess. Stay tuned.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the US and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, 22 minutes past the hour. With me today are Shashank Joshi and Tim Marshall. Now, today was the most hotly anticipated day on the European tour of the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, as he met his German counterpart, Wolfgang Schäuble, in Berlin. Schäuble was as strict as expected. He said today the reduction in Greek debts was off the agenda. The Greek finance minister tried to remind Germany of its own painful past by comparing Greece's problems with those of interwar Germany. And Varoufakis also pleaded with Germany to end what he termed a gross indignity suffered by Greece over its debts. Tim Marshall, where do you think the Greek finance minister will find a ready audience for that kind of rhetoric? Anywhere other than Greece?
Well, I was just saying Greece, and that's about it. But there will be other people that will be more polite about it. It's chutzpah of the highest degree, I think, that, oh, yes, you know, how dare you make us feel bad about this incredible mess we've got ourselves into, which is, I believe, the Greek decision. I know there is another argument that, oh, it wasn't their fault, but it was. They lied about their books, and the Euro countries accepted the lie, knowing it was a lie, let them in, and the house has come tumbling down. Now, what are you going to do about it? Germany's got two bad choices. Force the Greek exit, the Grexit, which weakens the euro. And if the euro falls apart, German manufacturing is hit and the German public doesn't like that. That's one bad choice. Another bad choice is to accept that you will say to Greece, I know you lied. I know you haven't really tried to pay your debts. I know you haven't reformed, but we'll let you off anyway. And what does that say to the other countries that are in not as bad positions? So they have the two bad choices, which is why you come to a fudge agreement, probably. The ECB will no longer accept Greek debt to pay for them borrowing more money. So we really are in the economics of the madhouse here. Mm-hmm. Greece was saying, we'll give you our debt. We'll sell you our debt so you can give us some more money so we'll be even in more debt. Well, the ECB said, we've had enough. We know who controls the ECB, the Germans. So each side is playing hardball. Each side is not wanting to blink first. The way ahead in about 3 weeks is that you agree you'll extend the loans and the conditions at the moment that Greece is under for about 3 months while you try to come up with a much bigger solution. So we're in the middle of process at the moment.
Shashank, does Angela Merkel have the toughest job in Europe, do you think?
With great power comes great responsibility, as someone very famous once said. I'm intrigued by the Greece dilemma here, by the idea that the best way to demonstrate one's solvency and reliability is to compare yourself to the Weimar Republic, yes. That well-known, highly reliable
country. But it was rude, wasn't it? Because that was this little hint of, oh, but you know what happened then? You lot became Nazis and invaded us, which is why it's rude.
Putting a gun to one's head. Yes. And I what I found really interesting about this is an example of how some of the most bitter diplomatic fights today are not between adversaries, but within alliances, between allies. You know, I'm thinking here, of course, of Benjamin Netanyahu's absurd little foray to Congress in March, and just the incredible diplomatic cack-handedness and the open fighting here. And again, within the heart of Europe, the Eurozone itself, between NATO members, EU members, core European countries, to see this level of bitterness, I think Merkel has enormous responsibility here, because the options Tim laid out have grave consequences for Europe as a whole. And I honestly don't envy her job.
Yeah, it's about peace at the end of the day. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a bit about how the Eurozone seems to be sort of riven then, Tim, at the moment, because a lot of people are talking about, debtor and creditor nations. But there also does seem to be something of a north-south divide. People are talking about, the Mediterranean nations. You've obviously got Germany, the Finns, who seem to be very sort of closely allied with the Germans on that point. Is there a north-south divide? Does it matter?
There's a slight north-south divide, but geographically there's also a periphery and a core. And the core is holding together, and the periphery are the ones, I mean, if you put Spain and Italy on the periphery, I mean, they're sort of just on the periphery. I think the whole North-South thing can be slightly overdone, and the whole Protestant-Catholic argument, I'm a bit suspicious of all that. But it does come back to the fact that the core could have held this together, but they invited the periphery into it, and now they're reaping the consequences. They're going to try and save the euro, and if they save the euro, they save the idea of the European Union. If they don't save the euro, the concept of the ever closer union is dead. Once the concept of ever closer union is dead, you either freeze Europe where it is, a nice big trading bloc with a lot of agreements, or it starts to come apart slightly. And if it starts to come apart slightly, the German question comes back, and that's what nobody wants.
I think from our point of view, we are injecting an incredibly unwelcome British question into this.
Yes.
At just the moment when all those fragmentary tendencies are showing themselves. And come next summer, possibly, depending on the outcome of the election, we're going to be adding new strains to that. And I think no one in Europe will thank us for it.
Well, let's pick up on that idea of unwelcome questions just before we end, because I want to talk a little bit about some embarrassing political moments. The British audience received a bit of a treat earlier this week as the Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, forgot the name of one of his party's main business supporters. Let's have a quick listen, deliciously, to what this sounded like.
I've been at a dinner tonight with a number of business-supporting Labour figures. The former chief executive of EDS, and who I was just talking to just a few moments
former
ago before
chief
I came over.
Of EDS,
of course, who's a big supporter of ours.
What's his name?
But to be honest, his surname has just gone from my head, which is a bit annoying this time of night.
Oh, poor old Ed Balls, the British Shadow Chancellor, trying to remember the name of one of his good friends. Tim and Shashank, that was Ed Balls on the BBC Newsnight programme. There is a bit of relish when you hear politicians squirming.
Oh, very much so.
But it's a bit unfortunate in some respects. I mean, does that go straight up, Tim, into your sort of top 10 of favourites, or are there others that deserve a loftier position?
It's in my top 10 of British favourites, but there are some fantastic international versions of it. I've only got one, but if we've got time, two very quick stories. By the way, congratulations to Emily Maitlis, who was the presenter there, because throughout the rest of the interview, she referred to, Bill Somebody, which really stitched him up. Two quick ones. Rick Perry, US presidential candidate.
His brain freeze.
He says he's going to get rid of three agencies when he becomes president. I'm going to get rid of the commerce, the education, and he goes around in circles for a minute, and then he says, let's see. No, I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops. The most famous oops in history. But a personal one. A long time ago, in another century and another life, I was presenting the sport on a radio station, and I said, "And here's the sport with..." And I'd forgotten my own name.
Forgetting your own name, I think that may take the gold award. Shashank, what about you? There's a few notable ones. I think of George W. Bush had a couple that he sort of
Well, Bush started with several, but of course, one of them, before he was president, campaigning in 2000, he referenced repeatedly the name of our good ally, the president of Pakistan. And when pressed to say, "Who is the president of Pakistan?" he said, "The general." You know, the general. And it transpired very quickly, very, very quickly. He had no idea what the name of the leader of Pakistan was. He got most of it, of course, yeah. And that the general would apply for most of Pakistan's history anyway, so
that's
he was
true.
Fine.
One that I always liked, which was Sarah Palin when challenged to name her reading materials of choice, any magazine or newspaper, and all she could say was, "All of them."
All of them.
That's a good answer.
Well, she's famously phenomenally well-read, so of course it's a fair answer.
Maybe that
answer.
Was just accurate comment.
By the way, yes. You can see Russia from an island off the Alaskan coast. So you can actually see Russia. Not from her house, and she never said that, but you can see Russia from Alaska.
Who'd have thought we'd wrap up with this strident defence of Sarah Palin? Not me, for one. But thanks to both of my guests today, Shashank Joshi and Tim Marcel, for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是Monaco24.
Op London, du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. France 24 correspondent Benedict Pavio will be in the studio to leaf through the French weeklies for us, and we'll hear what happens in a most impressive Himalayan setting at the first ever Bhutan International Festival. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines. Here's Paul Osborne.
The leaders of France and Germany have met the president of Ukraine as a new diplomatic push intensifies to try to end the country's crisis. François Hollande and Angela Merkel are presenting a new peace plan. Mr. Hollande has warned that if it fails, he could supply weapons to Ukrainian government forces. Both leaders are due to meet the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, on Friday. Meanwhile, NATO defence ministers have been discussing a new rapid reaction force for Eastern Europe. There's been no breakthrough in the latest talks on the huge debts in Greece. The country's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, was in Berlin for talks with his German opposite number. After those talks, he said Greece would not be humiliated. Jordanian fighter jets have launched their first strikes against Islamic State militants since footage emerged of the murder of a hostage from the country. Mawaz al-Kasasbi was burned alive by IS in the video released apparently several weeks after he was killed. Earlier, Jordan's King Abdullah met the pilot's relatives. And the scandal involving the Brazilian state oil giant Petrobras appears to be widening. Police have questioned the treasurer of the governing Workers' Party the day after the chief executive of Petrobras resigned. It's over claims that firms paid over the odds for contracts and some of that money was funneled to the Workers' Party. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York,
to Tokyo,
to Shanghai,
to Buenos Aires,
to Hong Kong,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Monocle 24. It's Midori House. The time here in London, 18:33, 10:33 in San Francisco. It's 19:33 in Paris, where, in a manner of speaking, we head next to take a look at the weekly magazines and news publications and the stories on their pages. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Benedict Pavio, London correspondent for France 24, who's here to cast an eye through some of the publications. Benedict, lovely to see you as ever. Shall we start with, well, I guess an issue that's kind of been thrown into sharp focus after events of the last few weeks, the banlieue, a lot of talk about the disenfranchised French youth, this sort of thing. And I gather one of the titles has been delving into that world this week.
That's right. It's the weekly L'Obs,
used to be known under the this left-wing weekly, used to be known as Le Nouvel Observateur. And there's a very interesting article, as you can hear me turn the pages on. Starts on page 35 and continues on the following pages. And it's about a suburb, a banlieue, as they're called. And this article is entitled Ghetto One Day, Always a Ghetto? And it refers to a brief statement that the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, made when he was actually meeting the media to, it's a very French tradition, give his best wishes for the new year to the French press. And he talked about France now being ghettoised, and that actually he used the word apartheid, that there was a cultural, social apartheid that existed in France. So what this article looks at is that 10 years after riots there that took place in 2005, that sparked a much wider, very serious revolt across France, where thousands of cars were burnt, where buses were broken, where people were attacked, etc., and it made world headlines. Has Clichy changed very much? Has it or not? And in fact, what the article says is that quite a lot of money has been plunged. Millions of euros have been plunged into Clichy and Clichy-sous-Bois. It's about 15 kilometres in the outskirts of Paris. But despite this money being plunged to it, despite 700 buildings and amongst them tower blocks, broken down tower blocks with broken lifts, with you know, tags, as we call them, graffiti all over the walls, broken windows, really sort of rough neighbourhoods. Despite that happening, and then 1,000 new homes being built, and really the authorities trying to encourage families to come back, and you've got more security, you've got a little garden outside your house, etc., that actually it's still a very run-down, poor neighbourhood that is actually plagued with unemployment, particularly youth unemployment. And it says, we know that of all the countries in the world, France has got one of the best transport systems. It's actually pointing out that although Clichy is only 15 kilometres from the centre of Paris, it takes an hour and a half to actually get there by public transport. And that, you know, one of the hopes is that actually the money that will be plunged into, and the work that is beginning on a tramway and a metro line, which is line 16, hopefully by 2023, will help people in Clichy to feel more connected.
Some way
to
into
Paris.
The future, though. I wonder. I mean, is there reference in the piece? Obviously, the events in Paris fairly recently threw up a lot of very, you know, stark questions about, I don't know, sort of, you know, race relations, the way that people are integrated or assimilated or marginalised within French society. And it's interesting you make that point about the transport. These are people who are quite literally separated from the city and from the opportunities therein. Do they sort of look at this story through that prism? You know, are there elements about how, you know, what becomes of a lot of these young people who are denied opportunities? There is high youth unemployment. What does that drive people towards? Do they sort of confront some of those questions in this piece?
Yes, I mean, what's interesting in one part of the article, it actually shows that actually the people who live there from many nationalities, I'll give you a few figures, interesting one and quite surprising ones in just a few seconds, is that actually people are very proud. Very proud of actually belonging there. There's one example of one young woman who says she was living a double life, where she was, by day, she was a trainee wanting to be in TV, in the media, and living one life. And she said, actually, the people in that world, her words and her impressions, were actually worrying about things that didn't seem to be problems at all, that she calls ego problems. You know, basically, that what she would say is a selfish kind of life and petty problems. And then she would go back in the evening to Clichy, where she felt she really belonged, and she felt that they were really two completely different worlds. So I said, I promised you a few figures. So this article actually says that the under 25-year-olds represent more than half the population. I think the population is something like 23,000, which is considerable. That it says that the rate of unemployment is twice as high as the national rate, which is serious, therefore is as high as 23.5%. That is considerable. In some areas, she says, of Clichy, it's actually even almost 40% unemployment. I'll correct myself. It's 30,000 inhabitants in Clichy-sous-Bois. She says, out of that population of 30,000 inhabitants, there are 33% who are foreigners. Of those 33% of foreigners, they come from 90 different countries, are represented, and that, which goes from Turkey to Kurdistan to Mali to Algeria to Cambodia. Again, it talks about the fact that there is very little employment, and in fact, the biggest employer, they're small companies, but there's no big employer, and the biggest employer is actually the local town hall that has 400 civil servants.
Extraordinary
so
figures.
A really interesting article if you want to get a feel for some of the things that are happening.
Well, and to
sort
of understand some of this disenfranchised youth, fascinating. Let's turn, shall we, Benedict, next to L'Express. There's an interesting thing here about foreign languages, because we rather use this as a stick always to beat ourselves with here in the UK about how poor we are at speaking languages other than our own.
And the British are lazy because everybody else speaks English. But actually, we know that in France 20 years ago...
We're practical, Benedict. That's what I would just qualify that, I think.
Okay, if that's your version of events, absolutely no problem. Somebody who's bilingual, bicultural and speaks French and English and broadcasts in both languages, I have no problem with that. Okay, let's have a few facts. In 1994, there was a law that was called You're Smirking Away. Smiling, I should say. La loi Toubon, and it's a law that I'm sure you're very familiar with, that forbid French people to use English words. You had to use a French word instead. So instead of saying weekend, you were supposed to say la fin de la semaine, the end of the week. Somehow not very popular with people. And so this was almost like a shield against English. And anyway, what it talks about is the appalling language capabilities of the French. It says that in a global world, this has become a really economic handicap, that it is extraordinary that in a country that has, that hopes to have welcome 100 million foreign tourists in 2022, and it is the most visited and popular tourist country. This is not a French tourist board advert, but it is a fact that France is the most visited and highly popular country in the world by tourists. But it is astonishing. So the French government and authorities have actually tried to challenge themselves and challenge French people. And so what is the slogan? Do you speak tourist? In other words, do you speak a foreign language, really? And I mean, the figures are absolutely staggering about the fact that French people are not speaking English. But one of the things that this article points a very big finger at is it's saying that it's partly the schools that are responsible. This kind of culture of saying, you know, don't open your mouth unless you're going to be word perfect, that actually stops people from having the sort of just throwing themselves in there, trying to, you know, make an effort. It's, what do the Americans say? Use it or lose it, as far as your muscles are concerned. I think that's very good advice. I don't mind if somebody has an accent. I think that it's like going into somebody's house. Make the effort. Try and string a few words together. That's so appreciated. Don't you find that when you travel?
I agree 100%, Benedict. And I think that's a fine note on
do you mean 100%?
On which to end. Life lessons as well as an assessment of the week's French weeklies. Doesn't get much better than that. That was Benedict Pavillot, the London correspondent for France Van Catch. Thank you very much, Benedict, for joining us.
Mon plaisir.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we're off to hear about the Bhutan International Festival and hear exactly what it's got to offer. Stay tuned.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
It's 1843 in London. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Time next for our daily foray into the world of culture. The tiny Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan is often thought a secret place and was largely closed off for tourism for many years. But Bhutan is now opening up, and as proof, this year the country and its much-revered royal family is throwing itself behind the first ever Bhutan International Festival. Encompassing cuisine, music, film, even a marathon, the series of events hopes to show off the country at its best, as well as to help liaison with international newcomers. A little earlier, I spoke to the festival's co-director, Ginny Galloway. We started by talking about the challenges of organising this type of festival in such a secretive country.
It actually hasn't been that much of a challenge. Actually, the fact, the air of mystery and the sort of beauty and the image of Bhutan has attracted more artists and more interest than we were expecting. We have so many amazing artists who've wanted to come and collaborate, and we've actually had a hard time being able to budget it all this year. So we've asked, invited artists to come back for next year and already started our slate for 2016.
Well, it sounds incredibly sort of exciting project. Tell us a little bit more about then how you go about, you know, curating that, bringing all of these elements together. If there is this rich scene there, what's the sort of process been like to gather all of these strands together?
Well, I think, you know, in year one, when you start an international festival, and particularly in a country that has, you know, has been a bit mysterious and certainly invites tourism, but is not as open necessarily as the rest of the world and other countries. Our approach the first year was really to, from our core team, to reach out to all of our pretty, you know, close artists that we've worked with before and curate very closely people that we've worked with. Particularly because we want to start this festival by laying a foundation of sort of artistic collaboration, which is really what the spirit of the festival is built upon, and keep it intimate and powerful year one with the intention to build it each year stronger and bigger, so that we have really strong roots. And the artists that we've invited, we've really reached out to our close circle of artist friends to make sure that there is a rich sort of process of seeding artistic collaboration and seeding these legacy projects that we want to see going forward. Every artist that we have invited has now scheduled a workshop and masterclass. So there's a real emphasis on knowledge sharing and collaboration across the board.
Well, let me ask you a bit more about that then, because obviously there's all these different elements to the international festival. We're talking about films, music, and so on and so forth. Is that idea of a collaborative approach very important? And maybe you could mention a few of the, I don't know, the artists or musicians who are sort of engaging it in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it is really the backbone of the festival, and it's really what the festival is built on. The whole purpose of the festival is to invite and inspire artistic collaboration and cross-cultural collaboration to really create and support a network for local artists and the arts in Bhutan. It's such a rich culture. There are so many talented musicians and painters and dancers in this country, and it's quite hard, I think, a lot of times for them to get access to collaborate and do knowledge sharing and sort of sharing of disciplines of arts with other artists. So this is an opportunity to bring some of the best minds together, but also for emerging artists who want to be able to have time with professionals, you know, to experience creating new work and sharing their artistic disciplines. And a couple of, like, for example, we have the members of the Harvard Radcliffe Orchestra coming, and they're going to collaborate with the local sort of musical expert in the country, a man by the name of Jigme Drukpa. And they're going to collaborate with RAPA, which is the Royal Academy of Performing Arts in the country that does the traditional mass dancing. So they're going to spend a week sharing different, you know, musical instruments and learning each other's, you know, traditional songs. And at the end, I do a collaborative performance for Her Majesty the Queen.
It certainly sounds like a delicious lineup. Just to sort of pick up on a couple of the challenges, I know you mentioned it was very easy, and obviously there's Bhutan has a famous reputation for delivering a warm welcome. But I wondered, you said it had been quite easy to put together, but people will naturally say, well, look, you know, there's the Himalayas. It's quite in some ways, a forbidding environment, I guess, just in the physical environment, the logistics. Has that been a problem at all?
Some people have said to us, like, you're mad. You're curating an international festival in February. It's off season. You know, what is going on? Actually, it's beautiful here during the day, and it does seem sort of remote and off the radar and hard to get here. But it's not really the case. It is a great time to come. There's a lot of availability. There is a nice sort of steady flow of tourists that do come in February. And I actually think it's the perfect time to allow space for these artists to come in and spend time, really sort of focus time working together. And also it allows space for the tourists who do come in, who want to become involved in the festival and obviously have a tremendous 10-day show that they can witness and be a part of and experience. And the festival was based on, obviously creating a platform and a network for the artists. But obviously, we're hoping that through the years, as we build this, because we are working to position this to be one of the go-to international festivals on the international festival scene. And I think that as it becomes bigger, look, they don't have as many flights necessarily in February, but the local airlines have worked so closely with us. And they have been tremendously supportive in making sure that our artists get in and that there's a lot of availability to get everybody in when we need them. So where I can see some people would say it's difficult, it actually hasn't been. Everyone's really come together to support this initiative and to make sure that everyone feels very welcome and that there's a lot of room for us to achieve what we've set out to achieve.
That was Ginny Galloway, co-director of the Bhutan International Festival. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's time for our daily arts review. Today we're talking books, and to give us her insights is the literary editor for The Independent, Arifa Akbar. Arifa, thanks for joining us on the programme. Great to have you with us as ever. Let's start perhaps by diving in to a Granta anthology, always a delight.
Always.
Looking at India. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, as we know, Granta Magazine for New Writing brings out these anthologies and gives us a portrait of a nation. For a bit of context, in 1997, they brought out India, the Golden Jubilee, and we got such fabulous writing there. We got V.S. Naipaul and Arundhati Roy, who was going to win the Booker that year. We got Vikram Seth. They were all writing. That was the heyday of Indian fiction. So heydays don't last forever. This anthology, what's striking about it is the non-fiction, the reportage. So you get really fascinating sort of insights into not just the usual, the poverty divide, the wealth and poverty divide, but just extraordinary. There's a short piece called Love Jihad on BJP obsessional men who have this sort of twisted obsession with saving the pure Hindu women from the Muslims who they believe are breeding, are luring their women and breeding children to go and fight holy jihad. And it's just an extraordinary insight into how Islamophobia manifests itself. There's another reportage piece, beautifully written, about an exclusive swimming pool club. Real throwback to the days of the Raj, where whites only, they still, to this day, as the reportage shows, are insisting on this whites only rule. And it's just extraordinary to see these elements of India. You get, there's good fiction there, but we can't compare it to the fiction heyday. Mm. Brilliant non-fiction.
I think it's really interesting that you seem to get these sort of episodes in sort of literary history where the strength seems to shift from, fiction writing into reportage. It's a strange dynamic.
It is a strange dynamic because Granta brought out Pakistan, their anthology about 2 years ago. I remember reading it. I remember being struck by the brilliance of the writing. But also there's all this conflict going on in Pakistan, Afghanistan. So conflict, as we know, makes fabulous fiction. You need conflict. And I think you're right, that wave of brilliant, exciting new writing, fiction writing, is coming out from Pakistan. But India's got all this really interesting reportage. So, I mean, there's a piece there about young Gandhi, how he comes to London and he's, you see this other side of him, he's desperate, he's a dandy, he's desperate to be taken seriously as a gentle English gent. And it's good writing, not great writing can be non-fiction, can't it? So this is worth reading for that reason rather than for you get You get good stories in here too. Neil Mukherjee, who was up for the Man Booker Prize shortlisted last year, has this really a story that you think is veering in one direction, an Indian American father bringing his son back to India to show him his homeland. You know, they both feel like aliens. They're doing the tourist trail just like, you know, anybody else would. But then it veers into a sort of supernatural. It draws on that Indian oral tradition of supernatural cursed stories, and it gets quite sinister and eerie. But so you get the occasional really sparkling fictional writing as well. But it's well worth reading just to see what's coming out of India, you know.
Certainly a good recommendation to kick off with. Let's actually pick up on what you're saying about the supernatural, perhaps, and a novella-sized ghost story from Roddy Doyle. That might sort of surprise some people, I suppose, to an extent. Dead Man Talking. What did you make of this one?
Totally surprising. Now, don't let the look of it put you off. I'm showing it to you now, and you're probably as underwhelmed as I am.
They may not be the first thing I'd reach for on the bookshelf, I have to be honest.
It just looks like a little school textbook, and it's just a slim little thing, and it looks a tiny bit tacky, but, you know, it's the literary equivalent of a sort of three shots of caffeine, because you pick it up and you look at it, you're underwhelmed, you start reading it. It's part of the quick read series. Roddy Doyle, as we know, won the Man Booker Prize, writes traditionally about you know, traditional Dublin Irish life. It's part of a quick read series. It's really aimed at prisoners who have, you know, prison has very low literacy rates, and this series is really tailor-made for them. So that put me off a bit, because I just thought, oh, it's going to have short words and, you know, easy subject matter. But so I started reading it, and it was, you know, it's the typical Roddy Doyle terrain. Marriage, they're well into it, Irish couple, go off to a funeral, you see the sort of Irish, you know, wake element. And then suddenly it becomes very terrifying, because there's a, you know, that moment in the Truman Show when it's apparent that there's a meta reality and it's all very chilling, and the penny sort of drops but doesn't quite, and you feel this sort of chill, this, you feel a cold. Well, you know, here on page 63 or something, I just thought, I actually wrote, this is terrifying, what's going on? And that was that Truman Show meta reality moment. So he's doing, he, you know, he knows, he's a good writer, and he knows how to capture you in 95 pages. So this is a fabulous commute read, because you'll read it in an hour or two, and it's, you know, you don't be put off by the whole adult literacy.
Look, delve within. The rewards within it are very
great.
The
brilliant thing about it is that you don't even realise it's a ghost story. It's a story about afterlife, really, and the way in which, it's not a sort of moralistic purgatorial thing, it's the way in which we perhaps punish ourselves for the badness of our own lives. So it turns, you don't realise you're reading a ghost story, you just think this is a bit of a kitchen drama, Irish blarney blah, and then it turns into this quite chilling thing on page 63.
Very now, Aretha, time is against us. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to very quickly sort of mention Stoner by John Williams, because
this
is something which has been, you know, trailed a lot. There was a lot of discussion last year. Just tell
last
us in a word or two what's happening imminently about this, and why you're sort of mentioning this again now.
April is the 50th anniversary of its writing. So it was written in 1965, all but forgotten, came back. Twitter campaign, the likes of Bret Easton Ellis and Ian McEwan and Julian Barnes got on the back of it. Now Vintage, its publishers, are going mad in April and saying, 50 years, here's this book, we've made it an immense success. So really, they're just showing off. I can't recommend this book highly enough, because it sounds like it's going to be deadly dull and it's unostentatious writing, but it's really slowly, it cranks up and it's really powerful. About a Midwestern farmer's boy, he falls in love with literature quite suddenly. You wouldn't expect it. He's got these big meaty hands, you know, you think you know where he's going. And he becomes an academic, and he lives a quiet, unremarkable life. He does what's good rather than what he has to do to get on. It plays with the American dream. And in the end, you end up asking, what's the worth of an ordinary life? Could he have had a better life? He'd been more remarkable, pushier. Or was it remarkable enough that he was just good?
That's the insights of Arifa Akbar there. We must leave it, I'm afraid, Arifa, for today. Literary editor of The Independent, of course, talking about Stoner, amongst other things. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to Shashank Joshi and Tim Marshall, who were here earlier. Thanks to our producer, Marco Sippi, researchers David Pleasant, Alia Masood, and our studio manager, Bill Luthi. That's all from us for now. Goodbye.